could sympathize with him, you know. Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We're going to have a fascinating program tonight. Our guest is Dr. William Borst, and we're going to be talking about his book, The Scorpion and the Frog. And Dr. Borst, of course, has his PhD, which he got from St. Louis University. He used to do talk radio himself, and he writes this: to deny that conspiracies exist is to deny history. While there are several chapters of traditional conspiracies from the Masons through the Bilderbergers, the book unveils the idea that have unified conspiracies into a coherent rendition of evil. This book is an excellent history of the city of God and the city of man in the ultimate culture war. And I really think that that really epitomizes what this is about. There is a conspiracy against God. Anybody who denies that hasn't been watching much television or seen very many movies recently. You saw the conspiracy against God manifested in the vicious and scrupulous bigoted attacks on Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ. Why? Because they didn't want that message to get out. Why? Because it beautifully exemplified the blood of Jesus Christ, which is really our hope of eternal salvation. For without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. But if you really get into the background of all of these various conspiracies, and there's not one individual conspiracy, there are many of them, they're bound together by a common goal, and that is the destruction of Christianity and, of course, the establishment of a one-world government. And they've been here since the beginning of time. But, you know, we live in the most exciting time in all history, a time when I believe all of the bits of this whole entire movement are coming together. There's never been a time where we would be able to have a situation where we couldn't buy or sell unless we had some sort of a number or be known by the name of the beast, which would be 666. There's never been a time in history where all the rulers of the world could see the destruction of Babylon. I mean, how could you possibly have that in any other time without television? So there are so many things that point to what's going on today. And, of course, if you don't understand the spiritual nature of the battle we're involved in, why, when times get bad, and they're going to get bad, you're not going to survive. So with that as a background, Dr. Boris, thank you so very much for being with us.
It's a nice introduction. You really summed the book up pretty well.
Well, I think it's a great book.
You didn't leave anything for me to say.
No. Oh, there's a great deal to say. There's so many details about all of this. And first of all, let's ask you that traditional... No, I'm going to wait till we get back from our first break to ask you why you call the book The Scorpion and the Frog. But how did you get interested in this whole incredible story that seems to have captivated you as it's captivated me?
You mean the story of the conspiracy or the frog and the scorpion and the frog?
No. The story of the conspiracy, the world conspiracy.
I guess what really kicked me out, I have a kind of a reactive personality. I listen to a lot of things, even Rush Limbaugh and people like that, who I do admire to a certain degree, but they keep knocking and making fun and mocking the whole notion of conspiracy. But I have three history degrees, and you can't study history without being aware that conspiracies of one nature or another have always existed. It is in the nature of man to conspire, the fallen nature of man, so to speak, to conspire. That's what history is all about. I think I kind of
hold that stuff right there.
Okay.
All right, fine. And so Dr. Boris was just saying that he feels that history is made up of conspiracies. And, of course, there was a conspiracy to kill Abraham Lincoln. There certainly was a conspiracy to kill Julius Caesar. Why should we be surprised when we talk about conspiracies today?
Well, the biggest conspiracy is communism. I don't think anybody denies that's always been a conspiracy. So, all right. So, but the point is that they keep making fun of it, and there are a lot of people, shall we say, with a loose screw or two, that believe anything and everything about everything. And there has to be sort of a guidebook or a handbook to judge individual things as a conspiracy. But what I did, I tried to come up with, as you said, a unified theory. As I just said a minute ago, as a part of a natural thing, that's in our nature to do that. I don't think they really, people don't really need direction. When you think of conspiracy, you think there's a few men in a little room in New York City someplace directing the entire world. And there might be some people trying to influence it like that, but the actual directions are inner. They're inner directed. And it's one of the idioms I use, or another metaphor besides the scorpion and frog, is the old beehive. You know, the workers in the hive don't really have to be directed. They do it because that's what their job is. They have it in their various bee-like genes. And people that have accepted the philosophy of the left, or the philosophy of Lucifer, if you want to go back that far, just do these things by natural. The pro-abortion people, the pro-gay people, and all those issues of today, pro-euthanasia, they don't really need direction. That's just, they all seem to have a common end. And I think it really is to subvert God and his creative powers.
Well, of course, the amazing thing is that sometimes people who've been pro-abortion can become pro-life. Sometimes people who've embraced the gay lifestyle can actually change, but ordinarily when they do change, there's a complete transformation.
Well,
it has to do with the relationship to God.
It's Paul of Tarsus.
Right.
Yeah, he got knocked off his horse. So, I mean, you know, the conversions do happen. A lot of these people are really good-minded, shall we say, or good-hearted in their own respect. Their direction, they've just been misled or brought a wrong message along the line of their lives. But I guess the term that Mona Charon uses is useful idiots. I mean, a lot of people that seem to have good intentions, but, you know, they just are they going in the wrong direction.
So. Well, I can sympathize with them because when I was very young, I accepted a lot of this false theology and false philosophy.
Sure.
I knew communism was bad, but what was wrong with socialism? What was wrong with trying to help people. What was wrong with wanting a world government so we couldn't have any more wars? All of these things seem so wonderful, and I still want to help people, and I still want to see an end to war. But I certainly not going to back the people who are doing everything. Well, hold that thought for just a minute here. Well, Dr. Stan, and I was just saying that, you know, at one time I was really almost a flaming liberal, embracing these ideas. Isn't it wonderful to help people? I believe we should help people, but we should not look to government to help people, because when government helps people, government enslaves people, and all you need to see what happened to the black population of this country. When government came in to help them and to do away with discrimination and to give them a better lot in life, and now over a third of the black population of America is young black men are either in prison, probation, or parole. 70% of black children are born out of wedlock. I really don't think that they need much more in the way of that sort of help. Before we had the civil rights movement, before we had the welfare state, the black family, even though they experienced discrimination, there's no question that they did. They were a cohesive unit, an important part of the community. And we've pretty well destroyed that. So now I begin to see the fallacy of my ways, and I no longer look to government to solve our problems. But I agree with you that many of the people on the left are good-hearted people. They just don't understand what's wrong with their solution.
You know, you put it correctly in the beginning. You said the difference between reality and illusion. I think to be a conservative or somebody that believes in the truth, you have to be a realist. You have to believe that man is the way he is. He's not perfect. He's certainly very weak in a lot of ways and deeply flawed, and that's what you have to guard against. I have a whole chapter on sex, so to speak, and that's probably been one of the greatest means of subterfuge, if you would, in this country. A whole couple generations of people who bought the Playboy philosophy and things like that have undermined our morals and have led to a near decay of the civilization, and it's because that people don't realize there's certain things that you just can't get involved in. Planned Parenthood it really recognizes that, and they try to get children, young people involved in sexual behavior way before their years, way before they're mature, or even know what the reality, so to speak. They go back to illusions. They fill their heads with illusions and dreams and romance and, oh, it's fun and it's pleasurable and all this kind of stuff. And before you have a bunch of sex addicts running around loose. It's evident everywhere you look in society.
But of course, it's nothing new. We had libertine, activities in ancient Corinth, and I've been to Corinth, where of course the temple prostitutes were a way of life and loose women, and of course not much there now except just a couple of old Roman arches, and the rest of the society was just totally destroyed. Sexual immorality destroys a society. You've got to have the basic building blocks of society, and it starts with a family, one man, one woman, and children, and from there you build.
Well, there's been like 23, 24 civilizations in recorded history, and all but one have fallen from within. And this is we're really marching down a natural road. I mean, the United States is, I think, in a period of decay, and I don't know. People, I do shows like this. They ask, well, how do you change it? How do you solution? I think basically you have to protect your own. You start with your family, and that's about all anybody can expect you to do. Sometimes things are just inevitable, and there's not much anybody can do, given so much, history. It's like sort of like the tube of toothpaste. Once you squeeze the paste out, it's very difficult to get it back in.
Well, it's sort of like what you're talking about. The genie's out of the bottle, Pandora's
right,
out of the box,
too.
The toothpaste is out of the tube, and our job is to get it back in again, but we have to try. I think we have a moral obligation. I think we can point out very simply that these things, I don't believe for one minute, happened by accident.
No.
I believe the Kinsey and his work were aimed at destroying the moral fabric of our society. I believe he was a wicked and evil man, but it was financed by the Rockefeller Foundation.
Right.
And this is what people don't really understand, and everything has been done to conceal that fact from the American people.
See, it's sort of like a hand-in-hand thing. Kinsey, nobody really directed him. He went by his own nature, but the Rockefellers recognized how they could use him and his philosophy to undermine the kind of society they didn't like, the God-oriented society, and they used Kinsey. But Kinsey came up with the ideas in his own twisted way of thinking on his own, so that was kind of in his nature. He's a homosexual, and he just was driven towards things, and he went from the gall wasp and collecting a little wasp, so to speak, to treating people like in a clinic. Again, you know, if you scratch any of these people deeply enough, you'll find basically Darwinians. The Darwinians believe that man is basically on the level of an animal, and that's really what we've become. That's really become prevalent in our society. People, the human being, is losing his and her value.
Well, let's get back to your book here, because going to be a fascinating subject. Now, first of all, the title, The Scorpion and the Frog. And
I'd like to tell our
listeners about why you called it the book, The Scorpion and the Frog.
Well, it's an old fable. And again, the point of my book, I'm emphasizing the natural aspect of conspiracy. It's sort of to shut up and silence some of the people that say, conspiracies and nuts, and people that believe them are wackos. It was a story that there was a great flood, so to speak, and the frog, and I love fables because animals can talk and kind of can relate to them better, I guess. And the frog is ambling along, getting ready to swim, being an amphibian, getting ready to swim across the other side. And the scorpion comes up to him and says, "Mr. Frog, I can't swim, and I have to get away from this side. Can you please give me a ride on your back?" And the frog looks at him sort of incredulously, and he says, "No, I'm not going to do that. You halfway out, you'll sting me, and we'll both drown." He said, "No, I promise I won't do that." So halfway out, as the frog is swimming, he feels this terribly burning pain, paralyzing sensation in the back of his neck. And the cover of the book is fantastic. The rendition that the artist got for me was just where I wanted it. He looks at him with these sad, sad, fatally wounded eyes and saying, "Why?" And the scorpion just says, "It's in me nature." And they both think. And that's the point of it. Some people, once it's out there, it's a natural thing. It's going to act the way it is. It's the way that you might say its intellectual genes lead it. Okay? Hello?
Let's get into some of the more well-known conspiracies.
Yes.
Where do the Masons fit into this? Certainly there's just this last few days why a National Treasure has come out on DVD.
Yeah,
so everybody can, we just watched it last night.
Yeah.
You know, and it talks about the Knights Templar, talks about the Masons and the part that they played in the creation of the United States. And, of course, even the police officer, the detective who sort of, he turns out to be a really nice guy who lets the hero off. But, just at the very end, why his camera zooms in on his hand. He's wearing a Masonic ring,
right.
And he is, of course, going to let this man off, who saved the Declaration of Independence. But you certainly get into this whole background that, maybe the Masons were here when America was founded. Masonry really was doing a good thing. Masons gave us America. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, first, a little background. The Masons and other groups, I read a lot of books on secret societies, and the Masons are just probably the most prevalent secret society in history, the ones that have probably done the most and lasted the longest. I consider people like the keepers of the flame, the people that have kept alive what is originally, I guess, called Gnosticism. Gnosticism is sort of the anti-Christ, anti-biblical thinking, where man's ego, the ego of the elite, was sort of emphasized as opposed to the submissive will of worshiping God and Christ and all that. And so Gnosticism is the belief in it, that elite have a certain knowledge that nobody else has, and they tried to maintain this through years, and you've had the Knights Templar and the Rosicrucians and various other groups that are in my book, including the Masons, and leading to the Illuminati, which really kind of merged with Masonry in Germany and then later France, rather, that fomented the French Revolution. The French Revolution is the Enlightened philosophy, which is the same kind of spirit that, it's sort of like a long relay race. They keep handing off one group to another. And the Enlightened philosophy really fomented communism, which gave us socialism and liberalism and modernism and postmodernism and all the derivatives, intellectual derivatives, that have caused these revolutions and the unsettling of the traditional Western civilization. Now, the thing about Freemasonry, the way they decided, it's sort of like the Council of Foreign Relations. The vast majority of its members don't really have a clue about its deep and dark secrets, whereas the elite, the upper Masons, are really the keepers of this Gnostic philosophy and passing it on to others. The one complaint I have about Freemasonry is that it has what you were talking about, good-minded, socialistic kind of good feelings about humanity, humanitarianism, But it's a godless humanitarianism. It's one that almost is, has this, the status of a religion or a non-religion, and it's more philosophical in its humanity or leanings towards humanism, secular humanism, than anything to do with religion. So that's why I'm a Catholic, and for over 1,900 years, Catholics were prevented or forbidden, so to speak, from joining the Masonry. It was only in 1965 at the beginning, in the Vatican II, that they took that stricture away, and I still really don't know why they did that, and I'm not sure maybe that was a good idea.
I think it was a terrible idea. Well, yeah. I hate to say this, but I am firmly convinced that there is Masonic infiltration into the Catholic Church, just like there's Masonic infiltration into the Protestant Church, because I believe one of their major thrusts of Masonry is to destroy Christendom, both great branches of Christendom.
I have a whole theory of infiltration in the book. There was a Bella Dodd, I think you and I had talked about her once before.
Why don't you go ahead and explain?
Let's just say, generically speaking, if you have a church, a Catholic church or the Protestant denomination, that all stand for certain Christian truths and religious values and the like, immorality, pro-life and all those things, and if you had an opposing philosophy, it seems to me that it would be incumbent on them to try to destroy that philosophy as well as possible. And most things, as I said, are destroyed from within. So the infiltration of those groups would be logical, I think. And Bella Dodd was commissioned by the communists in the 30s. She was doing a lot of similar work with the educational unions in New York City. But she was commissioned supposedly to recruit 1,000 men for the Catholic Church as priests.
Let me repeat that. 1,000 men. Bella Dodd was going to recruit 1,000 young men to go into the priesthood to destroy the Catholic Church.
Right, right. And, I don't know. And she testified. She gave this testimony in front of Congress 20 years later. And I don't. In all my research, I wasn't really able to ascertain how successful or how many men she did actually do.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. William Borst, and we're talking about his book, The Scorpion and the Frog. And, of course, we were just saying that Bella Dodd, who basically had been a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party USA, she was a fallen away Catholic, certainly looking at the world in the 20s and 30s and seeing really the disparity between the very, very wealthy and the very poor, realizing, of course, that the Great Depression had been engineered, and, you know, totally disillusioned with our free enterprise system, with our capitalist system. She became a communist, a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, and working in education to try to introduce communist ideas into education, but also commissioned to hire young men to go into the, or at least to recruit young men to go into the priesthood to actually, these would be communists who would enter the priesthood, who then would destroy the Catholic Church from within. And, of course, Dr. Morris was saying he doesn't know how many she recruited, but it would appear that she recruited a significant number. I know there was a gentleman named Carl Prussian, and I know he was recruited. He was a communist. He was actually a communist for the FBI, but he always talked about how he was actively recruited by the government. And I forgot whether he was going to go into a Protestant seminary or into the priesthood, but there's no question that the communists were going to infiltrate both branches of Christendom, and we're talking about a period 65 years ago. This is the amazing thing, the fact that most people don't understand that, and perhaps some of those people may very well be at the highest ranks of both the Protestant and the Catholic churches today, simply gives you an idea of how effective our army is.
But, you know, the way I look at it, and this is my theory, I don't really have any proof to it, but, and that's the trouble, I have a lot of suspicions and questions. Some of these things are very hard to prove because all the evidence has been destroyed or it's hidden or something to that effect. But, you know, they didn't actually necessarily have to be communists. The point, if one communist could recruit a number of homosexual men, I can't think of anything that has done more harm to the Catholic priesthood than the homosexual thing today, especially the ones that lean towards relationships with little young boys. And it seems to me one communist could get 10 or 20 of that type of person, and they would just follow their own quote-unquote nature, and things would take its natural consequences, and you'd have these hundreds and hundreds of terrible episodes of a child and sexual abuse and teenage seduction and all that. And that did as much harm as any communist undermining the faith or improperly using the sacraments or something to that effect. So I would not be surprised, and I couldn't prove it, that what has befallen the Catholic Church right now in the headlines for the last 3 or 4 years could even trace its roots way back, way to, as you said, 60 years ago, 65 years ago, as part of this effort to undermine the church through more of a Marxist philosophy.
Well, I'm sure it has, and I'm sure this has embarrassed the church
tremendously. Oh, totally.
And of course, it's, you know, some of these settlements are just, well, they're going to destroy the financial foundation of the church, and that may be, in some respect, the best thing that can happen to it. Even though I'm not Catholic, you know, it may take something like that to really, start on all over again.
Remember your history. There was the sale of indulgences, which doesn't seem really like a real issue with a whole lot of sex appeal, that actually split Christianity in half 500-600 years ago. And that was, up to this point, in my opinion, that was the worst thing that's happened to the Catholic Church. And it had its counter-reformation, so to speak, that probably strengthened it and led to the rise of several orders, and the church grew in many numbers since then.
Hold that stuff right there.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. William Borst. And, of course, we're talking about the problems in the Catholic Church today, the tremendous settlements that are being made as far in response to the pedophile suits and the lawsuits that have been brought against the Church for protecting pedophiles and men who are, of course, molesting boys. What was really so interesting, you know, is that Dr. Borst had commented that that 500 years ago we had a similar degree of corruption in the church, in the Catholic Church, and that was the sale of indulgences. And back there in the end of the 1400s and early 1500s, why, if you wanted to get into heaven, or you wanted to get one of your relatives into heaven, all you had to do was give a lot of money to the Catholic Church. And of course, what they were trying to do was raise funds to build St. Peter's Basilica. Sure. And of course, it was just totally corrupt. It was sort of like these Protestant ministers that says, give me the money and, you know, and I'm going to pray for it, and God's going to give you this tremendous advantage. We've got this throughout Christendom, you know, and there are still these evangelical ministers, you know, send me the money and boy, we'll get God to give you whatever you want. Well, it was the same old idea back there in the 1500s and 1600s, and of course, as Dr. Borst pointed out, this led to the Protestant Reformation. What Martin Luther did not want to destroy the Catholic Church. He wanted to reform. He was a reformer. He wanted to get away from what was really, of course, he felt was corruption. And of course, then there was a backlash against him, and they were going to burn him at the stake, and they never did. And so, you know, fortunately, then of course he survived. But this then caused the Catholic Church to have to, you know, reevaluate what it stood for. And wasn't that what led to the Council of Trent?
Yes, I think pretty much so. You know, it's funny, I was thinking what you were talking about. One thing about, I saw the movie Luther, and in the summaries on the DVD that they do at the end, one man made a very poignant point, I think. He said, Luther's problem, he was more Catholic than the Church was at that time. And it did, but, you know, I always believe good comes out of evil, and then the corruption of the Church changed, and I think it righted itself many years, but now we're going through another pattern, another cycle, so to speak. But, you know, Dr. Stan, you should be going to carpentry, because you've been hitting a lot of nails in the head tonight, because the secret of all, I think the linchpin of all conspiracy, if you ask me, is power and money. It makes all this go. That's the gas in the car, so to speak. Without the power and the greed for the money and things like that, when they often work hand in hand, there would be no conspiracy. I mean, people wouldn't be doing what they do because of their nature. But it always seems that if we have money, we want power, and if we have power, we try to use that to get more money. And then it never seems. And then the sex is sort of thrown as the sugar coating. You put the three of them together, and you've got my book, really.
Well, Chris, I really believe that there are some people who've actually made a pact with the devil. I really believe that there have. Certainly we carry some videos called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, where some of these people acknowledge, you know, on film, they have a pact with the devil. And my goodness, they've been so successful in the music industry, a tremendous financial advantage, tremendous popularity, sex, drugs, everything you could possibly want. And of course, they usually die very young, and of course, they have to pay their part of the bargain. That's the trouble.
We have a men's Bible study at my parish this morning, and I made the point that Karl Marx was a Satanist, and a lot of people didn't know that. And he was a born a Jew, I guess, and then he was a Christian. And then somewhere along the line, he brought the Luciferian doctrine, so to speak, and he became an out-and-out Satanist. Jane Mansfield, the centerfold from a number of years, always on February 14th, I believe. I have my chapter on Hugh Hefner and somebody else I'll tell you about in a minute. I found that she's a Satanist, and I think that whole idea of Satanism does, and the occult, it's what I think was part of Hitler's problem. I think he made a virtual pact with the devil. And you find people that adopt that kind of national socialism philosophy. Many of them, again, there's the useful, the worker bees, but then the ones that really do pull some of the strings, I think they are in league with the devil or a Luciferian kind of philosophy. Lucifer wasn't really the devil so much. Lucifer was the mirror opposite of God in that he rebelled against God, and he was, the personification of ego. And that's really what I think leads to all sin and all corruption, basically, is the elevation of one's own ego. And if you can fight that, you probably got the game half licked.
Well, I know, but there are other people out there who get together and sort of conspire against this. Sure. I really believe that there is an active conspiracy against God. I believe that's the common denominator behind all of these various groups, whether we talk about the Council on Foreign Relations, or the Humanists, or the Communists, Theosophists, or the Rosicrucians, or the Masons, they all certainly have repudiated the Christian God and the story of the Bible. And, the older I get, the more convinced I am that the Bible is true and pretty well it teaches them that God does rule in the affairs of men. We're going to be back here in just a moment or two with our special guest this evening, Dr. William Boorstin. We'll take your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. William Boorstin. Well, let's go ahead and get into some of the chapters of your book. Let's get into the one on Satanism and Hugh Hefner and Jane Mansfield. And, of course, I know the story that I heard was that Anton LaVey, she was a follower of Anton LaVey, right. And he had a premonition she was going to die. He told her not to go out driving that afternoon, and she did it anyway in this bizarre sort of an accident where they ran into the back of a truck and she was decapitated. And actually, her daughter is on the television today.
Right. Robert, Haggerty.
Attractive, a television star, but I suspect that many of the people, I don't know anything about Jane Mansfield's daughter, but I will tell you that many of the people who are working in Hollywood today are successful because they, of course, hate Christianity, and there is almost this common hatred of Christianity in Hollywood. There is a growing number of Christians there, however. I have a couple of friends who actually work there trying to bring people there into a personal relationship with the Lord. So you have this, this conflict even within Hollywood, and you have a growing number of Christians, the people who really control the major studios. Many of the major directors and all really are coming from the dark side, but there's a growing light there, so there's much to be optimistic about.
My book is really about the duality. You said in the beginning, the city of God versus the city of man. And you talk to some people, and they immediately think, well, it's mankinism, but that's a vulgarization or distortion of what my book's about. I think all of life is duality. There's always good and evil. There's always, the American League and the National League. It seems like the Republicans and the Democrats, everything has two sides to it, it seems. Coins have two sides, or records have two sides. But Mankinism was a belief that the good and evil were the equal powers, and nobody really knows who wins. But Christians have to believe, and they should believe, that good will always triumph, and no matter how things may get badly, they might get in a civilization such as ours. I mean, you have to believe that it's good will always triumph. And I always keep an optimistic sense. I'm not a pessimist. I'm basically a realist. And if your house is on fire, your house is on fire.
Let's get on into this issue of Hugh Hefner.
Sure.
Who was Hugh Hefner? What about this whole conscious effort to break down and destroy the moral fabric of our society?
Well, first of all, you got to look at Hugh Hefner as the recipient of this. It's, again, a relay race. The most, you were talking about Satanism a little while ago, and the first, there's three people I focus, or at least three major people I focus on in that chapter six, and the first one is an Aleister Crowley. Crowley was an Englishman who was an out-and-out Satanist. He was one of the most perverted people I've ever read about. His own mother called him the Beast. You know, that's some pet name to call your child, so to speak. And a series of marriages and all sorts of corrupt acts that you can read about in the book. But
I'll hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. William Vorst, his book, The Scorpion and the Frog. And before we do anything else, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get hold of your book?
Yeah, well, the publisher is Ex Libris, that's Xlibris Press, and there's an 800 number, it's 1-888, same as yours, I think, 795-4274.
Give that one more time.
Yeah, 1-888-795-4274. And that's probably the easiest way to get it. They're probably waiting for you right now.
All right, fine. So anyway, that's
a, and it's hardback and paperback.
Book. Right. And, of course, somebody's just called in and said that Jane Mansfield's daughter is converted to Christianity, and I think that's wonderful. And really, there are Christians, you know, that really are working in Hollywood, and they're sort of an endangered species. It takes a lot of courage to become a Christian in Hollywood. That could be the end of your career. On the other hand, you know, there are people like Mel Gibson have been able to survive, and I don't know whether he'd ever get another major part again, but I don't think he doesn't really need to work at that point.
After what he did with the movie, The Passion of the Christ, he doesn't need, he might own Hollywood, you know. I think what he did was a very brave thing. I was praying that he wouldn't lose his shirt in it. And to make over roughly $600, maybe $750 million on a movie as good as that, and he put it out in a language really nobody understands, Hebrew and Aramaic and a little Greek, I guess. And that's just an amazing thing. But the story is so powerful. The story, you know, they didn't call it the greatest story ever told for no reason. I mean, it is a very powerful story. And of all the Jesus movies I've seen, most Jesus people are, they don't seem real, but James Cavalli just really captured the best I think a human being could do it, and the humanization of his mother Mary was terrific. A little humor and back and forth, and it was really, I tell you, it was very touching, those flashbacks. I think Mel Gibson is a genius. I think the whole thing he pulled off was just terrific.
Well, I've heard some criticism because there's some things in there that aren't in the scriptures, like the snake in the garden.
Oh, well, yeah.
That was a beautiful point. I thought that the personification of Satan and of evil in the Garden of Gethsemane was a magnificent idea. And I think that that woman, I don't know who she was, people say that she wasn't a very nice person. She's an actor. This is all acting. And she did a magnificent job. You never saw anybody look so evil.
Oh, you don't mean to, and let me tell you, I think the passion in the garden was so scary, and so you felt his suffering, and you could see the real human Jesus bleeding, literally bleeding, sweating blood. And then when that snake came and he crushed his head, which is an allusion to Genesis, I assume.
Right.
He just, like God snapped back, you know. He got erect and he stood up there and he was tall again, and he stopped the crying and the whole bit. I tell you, that was a powerful, that was probably, to my mind, that was one of the most powerful moments in the whole movie.
I thought it was as well. So, yeah. I mean, because sometimes if you're going to do a movie, you've got to add certain things, and I think Mel Gibson did a tremendous job.
Oh, it's true.
Let's go on back. Of course, we're talking about this effort to corrupt our society, the Hugh Hefners.
I didn't really finish with that. I was going from Crowley, but what I wanted to say is Crowley was a very great influence on Alfred Kinsey, we talked about a little bit before. And Kinsey had a tremendous amount of influence on Hugh Hefner. I mean, Hugh Hefner wasn't gay or bisexual as the other two were. He was an out-and-out...
he was a plain old womanizer.
Oh, yeah, he was a woman. Well, he was a... You know, he married and young. He married probably too young. And then he just... in his job, you know, he was a cartoonist at Esquire magazine, if I'm not mistaken. And somehow along the line, he got this idea to start this men's magazine, And with Kinsey as an inspiration, he took her. He took, like, you know, like Gibson did to a degree. He took a big gamble. I mean, he probably had, he had a lot less money than Mel Gibson had to play with, but he took a thing. And getting Marilyn Monroe is sort of the first Jane Mansfield, I guess, to pose in the first issue. It sold 50,000 right off the newsstand, and he was in business from that point on. But the secret of Hefner's success, I guess, was the fact that, if you had been of the mind to peruse through the skin magazines of the 40s and 50s, it wasn't, I don't know how to describe it, it was a really blatant, these are that type of gals that you want to bring home to mother that would pose for that, those pictures, all right? What he did, he tried to do more, shall we say, I don't mean sophisticated, but more demure pictures of the girl next door, of course, without her clothes. That would be just like somebody you knew. It was a certain purity he tried to aim for, with, you know, the lascivious in the background, but a purity that would make nudity respectable and would make those kinds of pictures respectable. And the imitators that came along after him pushed the envelope several pages, several millimeters further. And I'm talking about Penthouse and, oh, that terrible Larry Flynn publication, yeah. And so I think Hefner felt to compete, he had to push his envelope a little bit more. And so I think Playboy became a lot more revealing, so to speak. And then the airbrush was not as used as liberally in this and that. And, you know, I'm not going to be graphic about it. But this became like a household institution. But what's really more important than the pictures were the articles. And even a person like William F. Buckley, you know, one of the diehard conservatives, he felt no compunction, even being a practicing Catholic, to write for Hefner. And there was the magazine within the magazine. And Hefner developed an entire philosophy of life, the Playboy philosophy, which is women, and it's very filled with irony, women were to be, you use the rabbit, the bunny, you know, a sign of reproductive thing is the bunny, and they reproduce like bunnies, but these bunnies were to be sterile. These were, if a woman had a child, that was the worst thing that could happen in the Playboy philosophy. So it's kind of a great deep sense of irony as far as that goes. But this philosophy of Playboy was really nothing but warmed over hedonism. It was a pleasure seekers, and it's not a, it's a life for infantile people. It's I don't think Hugh Hefner ever really grew up. I think some people have often, sort of like Michael Jackson, compared him to Peter Pan. You know, he's just a man that's and he's surrounded himself with just all pleasurable things, and I don't know what kind of depth a person like that has.
Well, I really feel very sorry for him because he's never had a permanent relationship. You know, he's been married many, many times.
No, just twice, actually. Only twice. The first one was his legitimate marriage, gave him his daughter, who's running the Playboy company now. And the second wife, he, after several years of his libertine behavior and bedding several hundreds and maybe a couple thousand women, he married one of the centerfolds, a very, in her own right, a very beautiful lady, but they had two children. And then he went back to his old ways, and he discovered, you know, two pills very important in Hefner's life. The first was the birth control pill, which kind of became, what's the word, enabled the more rampant free sexuality that he was selling without too many consequences. And then abortion, which is, he's been a prime supporter of the abortion movement and has a foundation that gives millions of dollars to NARAL and Planned Parenthood and places like that. So he needs that. And the other pill is Viagra. In his older age, Viagra gave new life, that he was dating seven blondes at once, so to speak. I don't know.
But I think the thing, of course, that, well, there are prices that you pay for promiscuity.
Sure.
And one is the rampant spread of sexually transmitted diseases throughout the population. When I went to medical school, there were 5 sexually transmitted diseases. I can only remember the names of 4 of them. Now there are about 20 sexually transmitted diseases. You know, and probably 20% of our young girls become sterile because of chlamydia. So many girls can't get pregnant, but they get the infection in their tubes, you know. And then, of course, the old joke, and it's sort of a sick joke about the difference between herpes and love, and that is that herpes was with you forever. And, you know, so many of the young people, their lives are changed. And I see these ads on television about, oh, now we have this wonderful new pill for herpes infection, and they probably won't get an outbreak, more than, maybe 50% will get only one outbreak. break every 6 months.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, if you're a girl and you've got herpes, it can influence your ability to get married, it affects your husband, how's he going to feel about it? Your child may be born with herpes encephalitis. I mean, your whole life is destroyed, and you can trace it all back to Hugh Hefner. God has rules, and you start violating those rules, why, you're going to get into trouble.
You know, it's amazing. You just generalize that, multiply that by millions and millions, and you can see what it does to a society.
Right.
A society can't live on herpes. It can't live on broken marriages. It can't live on multi-marriages. It can't live on divorce. It can't live on abortion or, and that's why so many people are dying to adopt people, because they can't have their own children. And I don't know if I've done studies on sterility, but I bet you I would be... What you're saying there is absolutely true. That's why there is so many sterile couples today.
Well, we got real problems in our society. We can trace it all back to this hedonistic practice. And, of course, you trace that right back to a revolt against God's laws.
Mm.
And those who will not be ruled by God will, of course, suffer terrible, terrible consequences.
Mm-hmm. So my first book was Liberalism, Fatal Consequences. And that way, ideas do have consequences. And that was really about the effects of what all this conspiracy things that I'm talking about now. Well, I sort of put the cart before the horse by doing that book first. This is probably the one I should have written first.
Well, our telephone number, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question for Dr. Borst, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. Well, let's talk about the Council on Foreign Relations.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Council on Foreign Relations? Should we be concerned about the Council on Foreign Relations? What influence does it have on America, on our government, on our foreign and domestic policy today?
You know, first of all, Tony Snow is a... I'm surprised. You know, I've read the membership list of who's in the Council on Foreign Relations. And it's they're mostly liberal people, people in the media, virtually everybody that's an anchor on television or thing. But Tony Snow is a guy I've always liked and kind of respected. And he's a member, and Buckley's a member. And I always wonder, what are guys like doing? Well, Snow kind of snippingly says that, well, they just sit around and, you know, you have to hope you don't fall asleep, and they have luncheons and this and that. But let's face it, in a conspiracy-minded kind of society where there's power and money at stake, When 3,000 of the most powerful people in a country or the richest people in a country come together in a single organization, you don't think they're talking about sports or, you know, fashion or stuff. They're talking about how to further conquer the world markets or further corner all the what natural resources may be left in the world. And a lot of these meetings are very secret. There's people like the Masons, they're sworn to secrecy. It's sort of like a derivative of the Masons and its organization and structure, I believe.
Really, it had its origin with a couple of Masons. In fact, Cecil Rhodes, who created the Secret Society, and Lord Milner, they came out of Masonry. The other two people in the Secret Society, one of them was William Stead. He was a disciple of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. He was into spiritualism. I've got his diary. I got his daughter's works, and, you know, there's no question they were all involved in the occult.
Right.
And, of course, Cecil Rhodes got his ideas from a man named John Ruskin, who was deeply involved in the occult. In fact, this whole idea can be traced back to the ideas of Plato with a ruling elite. In fact, Ruskin read Plato every single day. And you can read more modern people, the writings, say, of Leo Strauss or Bertrand Russell. They're all disciples of Plato. They believe we need this ruling elite that will rule the world, and the destruction of the family, and all women, will be subject to all men, and all children will belong to the state, almost like we have today. And you mentioned William Buckley. William Buckley comes from the Skull and Bones. William Buckley has been part of the CIA. I mean, William Buckley has been sold to the conservatives, a conservative leader. He always says the right thing, but look at the end result of what a great job he's done. So, I'm not quite as enthusiastic about William Buckley. I think I know why William Buckley is in the CFR. I think he's dedicated to world government just like all of these people are.
I have a kind of a 3 or 7 or 8 pages about Buckley. It's not exactly flattering, but it's interesting you mentioned Cecil Rhodes and the elite. Again, that's the Gnosticism, the idea that the special shall always rule, and that was the whole point behind his the Rhodes Scholarship was finding the best and the brightest of the world, like the Bill Clintons, I guess, educating them in the socialism, the Fabian socialism, I guess, of England of the late 19th century, and then they would go back to their respective countries, and then they would kind of, you know, work towards the downplay of nationalism and nationhood, and gravitate towards a one-world government. It's funny though. I think that's a human. It's, again, we go back to a natural thing, because you start with two individuals. Two individuals make a family, and families go into neighborhoods. Neighborhoods maybe lead to a tribe. Tribes lead to counties and states, and then governments and nations. And I don't know if all people being, you know, under a single brotherhood is exactly. I won't say it's not a bad thing, but it's almost like a natural thing given the way human nature has come. But as soon as everybody's unified in one government, it'll crash, it'll fall, because it's unnatural for everybody to agree in one government. There's always going to be people who want to do their own thing. That's why it's hard to get anybody to agree to things. Or you look at even among the pro-life people and the liberals themselves, I read books about how disoriented and how disconnected many of them are. That many people are more like stovepipes. They parallel work on these issues. And there's not a great deal of unity on the right, and there's not a great deal of real unity on the left, because it's in our nature really to go against the grain, so to speak.
Well, of course, unfortunately, so many people on the right today are solidly behind the administration.
Right.
So many people on the left are solidly against the administration. And ordinarily, of course, I would consider myself right, but the way things are going today, I hate to say, but I find myself in much more agreement with many people on the left.
Really?
They're opposing the war, and I don't oppose. I think this is a terrible, terrible mistake. Not only that, but our government today is the biggest spending administration. The Republicans are spending far more than the Democrats ever could have, in their heyday. And with massive federal deficits and massive trade deficits, they're going to destroy our economy in another, if we keep this up for another 6 or 8 years, why, the American dollar will simply be a remembrance of things past.
I think my last chapter 12, really locks in what's been going on with George Bush and his opposition and all that. To be honest with you, I don't have a dog on either side. I don't like either one of them. I don't think will have terrific consequences, because most of the people opposing President Bush are, as we've been talking about, the one world people that resent the idea of one nation exerting its suzerainty, its mono interest in the world. I mean, let's face it, we're probably the last superpower left. But my feeling is, the way I conclude, let me just first say this, though. George Bush is an heir to the American tradition. He's very much more in step with American history than any of his opponents on the left. And by that, I mean, you're familiar with the concept of manifest destiny.
Yes, and I think it's a terrible thing. I mean, this is the idea that America would come to dominate the world. That's the age-old plan of the occultists, not those people who value individual freedom. You can't have individual freedom in a nation that's dominating the world.
Well, it originally, manifest destiny was to dominate this northern hemisphere. But you couple it with another idea, which I found very interesting, and I did my dissertation on, sort of the essence of my dissertation, was the open door policy, which is the American imperialism, as it per se, is not the political type or the empire type.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. William Boyce, and we're talking about manifest destiny. And this was an idea that, well, they were flipping this thing around back at the time of the Spanish-American War. And America was she was to be sort of become a leader of the world, and we were going to have all sorts of new colonies. But there have always been those who wanted America to dominate the world. The average American didn't want that. There was only a very, very small number of people who did. But Dr. Boris has written a thesis on that, so he's much more of an expert than I am. Please pick up the story there.
Well, yeah, Manifest Destiny, I really trace it back from the 1840s, but you're right, Manifest Destiny was more after the Spanish-American War was extended there. But with our bad experience in the Philippines, which we lost 3,500 killed in 4 years there, so we're a third of the way there with Iraq in 2 years, we really disdain the holding of colonies. The only thing I think we were really concerned about was the economic influence in those areas, and we didn't want to really have to use troops to do it, because American soldiers are in those days and were more citizen soldiers. They'd fight their wars and they usually win them, and they'd come home and they couldn't wait to get out of uniform. That's kind of characterized our history up until Vietnam, at least. And you couple it with the manifest destiny, with the open door, and then it just gets traced through this whole economic imperialism, traced through up and through the Cold War, I guess. And Bush is an heir of that tradition. I think the Iraqi war is looking for stability in probably the most volatile area in the world right now, at least in the Middle East. And if we can get that kind of stability using our troops, that will allow for the American so-called free trade, which isn't exactly that free, throughout the world, which we can maintain our markets and our roots. And I think that's really why he's doing all this. And the neoconservatives, with a strong sense of protecting Israel as a side effect, or a very strong side effect of this, I think are the ones fomenting most of the philosophy behind it. And as you said, Strauss is probably the father of neoconservatism. But the problem with this, if George Bush does overextend our resources, as you were intimating a minute ago, that could bring the downfall of the American strength and I'm forgetting a word, and I guess it's getting late here in the
Well, that's for our listeners, yeah. For you. So it's about pushing midnight there.
No, it's only 11 here.
Okay,
but I'm thinking is the fact that we dominated the whole area, and if we overextend ourselves, maybe that's exactly what the one world people will want, because America will be kind of cut off at the ankles with its impotent as far as our economic might and military power, I think, has been dissipated a great deal under first Clinton and now Bush.
Well, so we're going to have to cover all these things in the next hour, but we'll be back in just a moment here.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Now, we do this 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, and then we do a weekend program. And last week, of course, I gave 3 talks in 2 days. This weekend, I'll be giving another talk in Los Angeles. So this keeps us pretty busy. But we do what we do because we feel that we need to share with you the information we've been able to glean after some 43 years of research. And then, of course, have fascinating speakers like we do tonight. Dr. Boris has been studying this for a long time as well, and though we may have slight differences, we both recognize the spiritual nature of the forces that are aligned against freedom today. So if you would be interested in helping the Radio Liberty family, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and you can join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and get our 4 best tapes of the month, as well as a newsletter, or simply get the newsletter on a monthly basis. If you'd like a free copy of the newsletter, let me suggest our March newsletter, which is The Myth of the Two-Party System. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Now, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. If you want to know how this whole issue is going to affect you and your children, we have a wonderful book. It's a new book. It's on autism and how there are wicked people in government who have known for many years that the mercury that they were putting in the vaccines were going to destroy the minds of our children. And they did it anyway. The book is called Evidence of Harm. It's a very touching book. If you can read this book without weeping, why, there's not much hope for you. The tragic stories of the families, Evidence of Harm is so vitally important. And then we have a 4-tape set on mercury, and we have a video on mercury. And, of course, it's well known, of course, that it's related to Alzheimer's disease and the elderly, and the incidence of Alzheimer's disease is skyrocketing. If you don't know, Dr. Pudenberg, one of the deans of vaccinologists, has pointed out that if you are foolish enough to listen to what you're being told and take an influenza shot on a yearly basis, and you're between 60 and 65, you take 3 to 4 shots over a 5-year period, your incidence of Alzheimer's disease 10 years down the line increases 1,000%. Why would they do that? well, aren't there too many people in the world? And after all, how are we going to finance all these old people? And so they're taking their influenza shots. Now, the doctor is Dr. Fudenberg. You can go to his website if you can't find it. Well, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you the abstract of his article. You have to understand, there really are wicked and evil people. You need to get the book, Evidence of Harm, about what they're doing to our children. And then to understand what they're doing with water fluoridation and why they're fluoridating the water, because Europe doesn't fluoridate their water. They wouldn't do that. You need, of course, to get the book. It's entitled The Fluoride Deception. We have a great new syllabus with a lot of the wonderful documents on that. We will have a video on this very, very soon, the talk I gave this last weekend. But if you'd like to get the book, The Fluoride Deception, why we recommend that. They're poisoning our children with aspartame. The book, Excitotoxins, The Taste It Kills. We have four tape sets on aspartame. That's NutraSweet if you don't know what it is. It's made up of methanol, which is a deadly poison. And aspartic acid and, of course, phenylalanine, which in high doses, of course, are extremely toxic. And believe me, kids are drinking their Diet Coke and all their other diet drinks are loaded with this, and of course destroying their minds and their endocrine systems, and of course creating tumors, and of course pathological obesity. That's one of the real signs of NutraSweet. And you hear all this talk about obesity, and the government keeps telling you, oh, they're just eating too much. They're eating too much because we've harmed their minds and produce permanent brain lesions. At least they does it in animals. And the animals who used aspartame developed endocrine disorders and obesity when they grew up. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here again, here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. Our guest this evening, Dr. William Borst, we're talking about his book, The Scorpion and the Frog, which is a great overview of the various organizations that we face today that are intent upon destroying, in my estimation, Western civilization, and they have an objective, and that is a world government and a new world order. We were, of course, during the break, I was simply talking about what is happening as far as the use of fluoride in our water, and certainly all the fluoridated things that they're giving our people today, knowing full well it's a deadly poison and reduces fertility and produces tumors and certainly lowers the IQ and endocrine dysfunction and osteomalacia of the bones, and they know all of these things. They just don't want you to know about that. And then, of course, what they're doing with the mercury in our vaccines, what they're doing with the mercury and even in the dental fillings, which are constantly venting into our system and definitely can be traced and tracked to Alzheimer's disease in susceptible people. And then with the NutraSweet, which are poisoning generations of our young people, going back to 1980 when Donald Rumsfeld got that introduced as a food substance over the objections of the people in the FDA. And, of course, it continues being used today and given to our children with disastrous results. They know what it's doing, and they're doing it anyway. That's what's so evil. There really is evil in the world, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, now we're going to get back to our discussion. And we were talking before we went to the break about this idea of manifest destiny. And of course, what will the end result of our current policies be? And I had raised the point, and I really believe this is very much true, and I believe even Paul Volcker has pointed this out in an article on the 10th of April of this year. This is just less than a month ago, in the Washington Post, where he talks about how there is no way that what we are doing is going to be able to continue. He points out that he doesn't know whether it's going to happen with a bang or with a whimper, whether it's going to be sooner or later. But there is going to be a major crisis, and it'll probably be a financial crisis. It could be headed off, but of course what needs to be done is seldom done, is put off until later, and then it's too late. And as he said, I hope that will not be the epitaph for America. When the former chairman of the Federal Reserve Board makes that statement, when a man who's long associated with this whole world conspiracy with the CFR, with the Chase Manhattan Bank, one of the most powerful men in the world, tells us that we may be on the verge of a financial collapse, why, I think maybe somebody out there ought to begin listening. Well, you pick up the story from there, Dr. Morris.
Wow, that's scary stuff. I mean, for Volcker to say something like that. Economics is kind of the dismal science and this and that, and people really don't... the people I deal with, I'm still on the radio, by the way. we've had some shake-ups at the station that he made in the New York Times, but I'm still doing my 2 hours every Wednesday, but... I don't think this country can continue spending this way. I mean, it seems like, you know, you said something about the Republicans are now doing. They're doing what the Democrats have done for 50 years, and the reason for that is it's money and power. The Republicans are now in power, right, and they've got the controls of it. And I was of the mind that I thought they would do something to bring things back, but those things just don't happen. They become as corrupted as the people they replaced, and that's the trouble with power. It corrupts and corrupts absolutely.
Well, but you see, if we had a divided Congress, if we had the Congress on one side and the presidency on the other, why we would not be in the mess we are today.
Right, right.
But when you have all that power with one political party, and they seem to be hell-bent upon bringing democracy to the world, why would they want to bring democracy to the world? We're not a democracy. Democracy has never worked throughout all history. Our founding fathers spoke out against the concept of democracy. They wanted rule by law, not by majority vote. And that's why we were Republican, never to be a democracy.
Well, I'm not sure at least the rhetoric is what they say. Supposedly no democracy has ever attacked another democracy. And again, back to my point of maintaining the avenues and the highways of trade throughout the world. And if everybody were a quote-unquote Democrat, I guess they believe, whether falsely or correctly, that there will be no more wars. No, economics hates one thing, it's disruption, uncertainty. The more certain people are of sending their goods, making their goods, buying their goods, that helps speed commerce. And if there's wars, there's no greater disruption to world trade than wars. I think World War One and World War Two really presented that argument.
But did you ever stop and consider the possibility that these wars were precipitated intentionally to create such disruption that they would force us into a world government?
Well, I think those things, I said, are hard to control, but some forces are put in to play that would, I guess by nature, getting back to natural conspiracy, lead us to those kind of consequences. Yeah, there's people that I think tried to use that. I've had my series of doubts about the 9/11 attack. There are conspiracy theories of all kinds about that. Some of them are really, really far-fetched. Some of them are really out and out ridiculous. But it certainly had the effects that any conspiracy would have wanted. It gave almost a surge of power to a president that wasn't exactly the most popular president. at least to start, one that had been elected under a cloud of suspicion, shall we say. I mean, I think there was a really messy election on both sides in 2000. And so it, from the standpoint of his political power, I don't think anything better could have helped George Bush. But I would hate to think that, I don't think him personally, but who knows, were there powers that put that into procession there that would lead to that kind of attack? I don't think he's... I think the Islamic world had tried to blow up that building, those buildings in 93, so it's not exactly unheard of, but did somebody let our guard down so it would happen, so there would be an excuse for the government to... for the Bush presidency to ride high for? I don't really know the answers to those, but again, I have suspicions of those things. You know?
Well, I know one thing, and that is that somebody is intentionally putting out a lot of conflicting information, yeah. A lot of stories that, you know, in fact, you put out so many stories and so many clues that people cannot think effectively about what's going on. What better way to confuse the people than to overload them with information, conflicting information, yeah. And then, of course, pull the rug out from underneath it. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, my feeling is that the question comes up, did George Bush know ahead of time? No, George Bush did not know ahead of time. Intelligence operations never are revealed to the president. Why? Because if it could ever be shown that the president was involved in something like that, it would bring down the government. So, you know, I remember Admiral Poindexter talking about Iran-Contra. He said, we never told President Reagan what we were doing. He would love to have known what we were doing, but we would never tell him what he was doing, so he would have plausible deniability. And I think you saw that manifested on the morning of the attack, when, you know, after the president has been told America's under attack, he sits in the classroom for 6 minutes reading a story about a goat to the children. Now, people say, well, gee, he didn't want to get up and frighten the children. Well, I think he himself was frightened to death. He realized the implication of what had happened, and he didn't quite know exactly what to do. But I think that there were other people behind the scenes who knew exactly what was going on, and you only have to take the example of the passports. I mean, of all the things that survived the flaming inferno in the North Tower and the flaming inferno in Pennsylvania, there were two passports, and we have the government records from the 911 Commission that talk about it, if any of our listeners would like to know. And one passport was from one of the people who was supposedly in the plane that crashed into the North Tower, and it somehow got out of the pilot's pocket, out of the hijacker's pocket, and out of the flaming inferno of the wreckage, and out of the flaming inferno of the North Tower, and floated gently down to the sidewalk, and was picked up about two blocks away from the North Tower by a passerby and turned into the police. And, of course, in perfect order, and it identified one of the hijackers. Now, if you believe that story, you probably believe anything. But what's even more incredible is another of the hijackers' passports got out of the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania and floated down to the ground. It was a little bit burned. It was up on the FBI website for a few days, and we actually have pictures of that. How could that possibly have happened? Forget about all the other disinformation they put out there. Somebody is trying to confuse the American people, but those two passports tell us a very clear story. Either this was the most miraculous thing, you know, that ever happened since the virgin birth, or those were planted, and somebody knew who those people were ahead of time because they had to make the passports ahead of time. If you stick with that one fact, those two passports, I don't think there's any question that somebody is not knew this was going to happen, knew who was going to be on those planes, and planted the passports. There's no other explanation.
It's sort of like the magic bullet from Kennedy.
Right.
The magic passports.
Right. That's exactly the analogy that I've used. But, you know, and that is what's so horrible to contemplate. There could be people that evil, but when we're talking about the sort of things we're talking about tonight, should we be surprised that there would people would be that evil?
Well, you know, it's the end justifies the means. It's very Machiavellian, but I can understand, I don't accept it, people convincing themselves of the righteousness of their cause that they need to get it. Like, take Franklin Roosevelt. I don't think there's any real doubt if anybody knows anything about history that he knew in advance that Pearl Harbor was going to happen. I mean, he didn't send the Japanese after our planes in Hawaii, but the very fact that I've read testimony for a transcript from some conversation between Roosevelt and Churchill, and Churchill warned him at it, and Roosevelt asked him what he should do, and I think Churchill told him nothing, because both of them wanted American entry into the war to help the British. And same reason, I guess, we got in World War One to help the British. And again, you go back to the cozy relationship between the Anglo and the Americans with the Council of Foreign Relations and the groups over in, you know, Cecil Rhodes people. It was a round table, I believe. And things like that. So I'm not really surprised that those things happen. And, you know, and Franklin Roosevelt sacrificed, was willing to sacrifice 2,500, maybe didn't think the attack would be that devastating, American soldiers for the good of the whole. Was Coventry, Churchill allowed it to be destroyed, 800, 900 people killed by the German bombers, because other than let them know that they knew they were coming. So, I mean, those are calculated decisions, I guess, commanders in chief do make, and they think they're justified. I guess I wouldn't want to be in their shoes, but for the good of the whole. And as I said, it goes back to Machiavelli.
And it truly is Machiavelli in so much of what's going on in the world today. But, you know, my view is that these wars have been created, each one of them, to move us closer towards this world government. The First World War was to bring about the League of Nations. The second was to bring about the United Nations. Korea was to quell the concern in the American people about the fact that we had turned Eastern Europe and China over to the communists. Vietnam was a wonderful diversion as they transformed our society. And we have the writings of McGeorge Bundy and the January 1967 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, saying it's really, you know, the road forward at home isn't by getting out of Vietnam. Don't say we ought to get out of Vietnam. Why, the road forward at home is by persisting in Vietnam. If we pull out of Vietnam, there'll be tremendous reaction to our policies. And for those who don't know, McGeorge Bundy was National Security Advisor, member of Skull and Bones,
right,
member of Council on Foreign Relations, close personal friend of Henry Stimson, who was Council on Foreign Relations, Skull and Bones, Secretary of War during the Second World War, and instrumental, of course, in this whole Pearl Harbor mess. And George Bundy was the man who, of course, was instrumental in getting us involved in Vietnam. So these are, of course, and they even wrote a book together called On Watch, George Bundy and Henry Stimson. So these, in my estimation, very evil, evil people.
I think Stimson also was a great inspiration of both George Bushes. I think I have some anecdote in the book, if I can remember it, about where one of, I think George H.W. was walking on the beach, and he was reading Stimson, and they're both Yale people and Skull and Bones people, as you said, and all that. I have a section in my book on the influence of that. I mean, these things, you know, let me tell you something, Dr. Stan. I use the analogy myself about people who believe in conspiracies, about people who believe in intelligent design. Things happen for a reason. The people that believe in evolution are the people that don't believe any conspiracy, because, and I think they're kind of naive and maybe a little stupid. They believe that they're the people that believe evolution. You know, it just happened. Oh, yeah, all these things that just happen randomly. I think that's an anti-intellectual position to be an evolutionist. I think it's ridiculous.
That's a very good analogy. I hadn't thought of that, but it's absolutely true. And, of course, why don't you tell our listeners about Skull and Bones? What can you tell them about Skull and Bones?
Well, it's I don't know off the top of my head. It's had three presidents now. Well, let's put it this way. Over the years, there's been, a few hundred members of Skull and Bones, and three of them have grown up to be presidents or gone on to be presidents. It's sort of along the lines of a mutual aid society. It has elements of the Masons. It has elements of the Council of Foreign Relations, secrecy, elitism, the very fact that these people will help each other and kind of lead them through lives. And you're not allowed to tell any of their secrets. And to have two members of this same secret society, this renowned, highly secret society, run for president has to tell you something, you know.
Well, yes,
what are the odds of that happening? 1 billion to 1 or 5 billion to 1?
I think about 5 billion to 1, maybe, if you're very conservative. Yeah. You know, but the thing is that this organization has strong occultic overtones, and the people who've been in the tomb there, that was the meeting place at Yale, describe all the swastikas on the walls, but the media never mentions that. But there are all the sorts of Nazi memorabilia, and people's, I think they have, what is it, Cochise or Geronimo's skull?
Right.
I can't remember which one it is.
I think it was Geronimo.
Geronimo's skull. I mean, why would they want Geronimo's skull there?
And, well, you know, again, you can say that some of it's attribute it to pranks and sophomoric stuff of college guys, but there's some really weird goings on that they're supposedly naked in a coffin and they have to recount their sexual experiences or something. And they might even go further than that. I'm not sure. There's a book quoted at length in the book. The woman wrote it that she actually was allowed to enter some of the areas of there. And she discounts a lot of this as myth. You know, there's a lot of denial around people that belong to a secret society or believe or actually participate in any of this stuff. And again, all you can say is, well, they deny it. And, it doesn't disprove it necessarily. It's just your word against my word. And again, a lot of times the proof of these things die with the members, and it just raises a lot of questions and a lot of suspicions. Why would anybody want to join a secret society?
Because it's a path to power. Because there's something mystical about it. I think once you are in this, you're in it for life.
You're right.
What is the most amazing thing is I don't think any member of the Skull and Bones has ever come forward and really told the truth about their organization.
They're not allowed to, and then like the Masons, I won't say there's pain of death for the Skull and Bones, but there might be severe penalties for it. I don't think anyone would risk it. I think they asked both Bush and George W. Bush and Kerry in a debate in this last election about that. Neither of them wouldn't tell anything because they're sworn to secrecy and they really stick to it.
And of course, both of them said, the organization is so secret, we can't discuss it. Now,
right.
I want to know, where is the president's loyalty? Is it to the Skull and Bones, or is it to the Constitution and to the American people? And I would feel that he should renounce his membership to this secret society, and whatever that secret oath is, he is sworn to. How many people out there who joined college fraternities really give a second thought about the oaths that they may have sworn or their the brotherhood that they were in. I mean, that's something you do in college. But of course, with Skull and Bones, once a bonesman, always a bonesman, and you dare not leave.
I think it's a scary group, and the very fact that one, maybe we could have had a second president as a member, it leads me to believe that, Yale is, as you said, CIA's got strong connotations with that over the years, and too many powerful people who belong to it. I really kind of get upset when there's so much power is concentrated in one place.
And I really think that that's really where we have to be concerned.
Right.
I mean, Skull and Bones dominates the educational system. It dominates the CIA. There's a special component of the CIA that they call the Bones Section. It dominates banking.
Right.
It dominates and always had people in key positions in our government. And when we have two presidents, separated only by Bill Clinton, who come from the Skull and Bones, it's almost like we have a hereditary presidency. Does that concern anybody? Another Bush, of course, is the governor of the state of Florida, and their votes swung the election to George W. Bush. We'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, our guest this evening is Dr. William Borst, and we're talking about his book, The Scorpion and the Frog, A Natural Conspiracy. It's a fascinating book, a fascinating overview of all of these various organizations. Well, where does the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergers fit into this whole menagerie of secret organizations?
Well, again, I guess it's to try to make it a worldwide thing. The Council of Foreign Relations is predominantly American. Let's see if I get these straight. The Bilderbergers and the Trilaterals kind of expand the horizons to include more foreign countries, even Asia. And again, what intrigues me is these groups there will have the most powerful people in the world meeting together. And what do you think they're talking about? The weather? I seriously doubt it. Again, I don't think they're directing the culture war that's going on in America, but I think most of them are concerned about power, money, and will use whatever means is necessary. If it means undermining a culture or even a civilization, so to speak, I think they're going to do it. Maybe the culture war now is just to distract us from the real, more important issues, and that is the concentration of power and money in a few hands. Maybe that's what it's really all about,
Well, what about their attitude of undermining religious belief? Because isn't this being done very intentionally? Isn't the Catholic Church really under attack? Isn't the Protestant Church under attack? So why would these people be so intent? Why don't they just let the foolish people, or whether they have foolish religious beliefs, have them? Why are they so intent upon destroying religious belief?
I think religious beliefs create men of character and women of character and family and I think that they're threatened by that because if a person, See, the Catholic Church has been counseling its millions and millions of members for a long time not to be so materialistic, not to be so consumeristic, so to speak. And I guess that hurts business, so they've almost maybe find some of those things that are thwarting their control and power. And independent thinking, you know, they don't want any independent thinkers, and that's what the family produces, people that think for the family, they think for themselves, they don't want to be, they don't make good subservient people in a world government if you have a strong family. It has to, the only family that exists really is the state. The super state, so to speak.
Have you got into the population control programs at all?
No, well, not directly. Other than abortion in my first book, I think there are the environmentalists. I don't know if are really part and parcel of the whole thing. In fact, a lot of them are anti-capitalist, anti-big business, and maybe the enemy, so to speak. But again, they're a neat diversion. And they feel that maybe there are too many people in the world. You know, maybe I don't know if the businessmen were like that. I think they look at more people as more consumers. So I'm not really sure exactly if the environmental movement fits in. It's just a means of control, perhaps.
Well, is this possibly a controlled opposition? Because who's financing the environmental movement? Who's putting up the big bucks for the Greenpeace and for all of these various groups? And, of course, if you look at it, it's the big corporations, the big foundations. So what you have is a controlled opposition.
And then you're going to have the dialectics
all over again. You're going to have the two forces fighting back and forth. And as long as they want the environmentalists to be successful, they will be. And then, of course, when they don't want them to be successful, well, we saw that with the effort, of course, to stop nuclear energy. Why? Right. Because big oil didn't want nuclear energy a competition. And now, of course, the nuclear power and technology and many of the plants have gone from weak hands to strong hands. And now, at this time in history, suddenly they're saying, hey, we're going to have to go back to nuclear power. And where is the environmentalist? Why, they're sort of going right along. You know, and I think it's time people understood so much of what's going on today is simply rhetoric over reality.
I guess I like the way you put it, controlled opposition.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. William Forrest. His book, The Scorpion and the Frog, an excellent overview of the conspiracies we face today. And once again, would you like to get out your telephone number and do you have a website, information, for people that know how to get in touch with you or get copies of your book?
No, I haven't really gotten the website yet. I'm too busy trying to write my other stuff. It's 1-888-795-4274. It's 888-795-4274. It's Ex Libris, Ex-Libris Press. And they're selling hardbacks and paperbacks, so either one if you wanted it. I tell you, this cover, Stan, is a really beautiful cover. I don't know if you have it in front of you, but the way the scorpion is, and I'm glad they did it anatomically correct. He's actually stinging. I thought they stung with the front of their face. I didn't know how a scorpion stung, to be honest with you, but he's doing it correctly with his long tail right into the back of the poor frog's neck. It's horrible, but I mean, that's basically maybe the way we are, you know.
The surprised look on the face of this frog, he says, you know, he's saying, why are you doing this? You
know? Well, he should know, because he bought the message, and so many people in this country buy the message like unsuspecting frog. I use also the analogy, I'm into frogs, I got warts all over my hands and all the frog stuff. I got a chapter, I think chapter 3, the natural, a nation of frogs. And it's about Antonio Gramsci and all the cultural Marxists and people like that, I think, that have convinced people that, you know, the other story about the frog, you put him in a pan of hot boiling water, he's going to jump out. But if you want to really boil him, you put him in tepid, lukewarm water and you gradually increase the temperature till he starts to sweat a little bit, he'll be overcome and he'll be cooked. And I think that's what happened to us, these gradual, incremental erosions of our culture. And cultures like, polluted cultures like the air we breathe, and we breathe enough of polluted culture to television or Playboy or stuff like that, we're eventually going to have bad lungs and not be able to breathe pure air, so to speak.
Well, you've got a chapter in here on Plato. Why don't you cover your impression of where Plato fits into all of this? Because after all, this fellow died, you know, what, 2,300 years ago. So why does he have anything to do with what's going on today?
Well, which chapter is that?
You've got a chapter here on Plato.
Plato's Apostles. Basically, it's chapter, I'm just going to read, I think that's the, That's the one on Cecil Rhodes. I think we'd already talked about that.
All right.
I think you summed it up pretty much about the Republic and John Ruskin and all that. I just call it Plato's Apostles and the fact that they've taken his Republic, which is, I guess from what I understand, a good outline of fascism, where, you know, various, it's not a democracy or representative government as we had supposed to have in this country, a Republican form of government. It's not a real republic, but it's basically gives power to the elite, and that runs through the whole book about it's elitism, it's Gnosticism, it's all the few judging and controlling the many, and that's what the story of life. And it's really ironic. I'll tell you one irony. I didn't get a chance to comment, and you mentioned about the development of war, so they could have the League of Nations and the United Nations. Isn't it ironic they will have a world war, or try to start one, so we can have peace? Is there something wrong with that?
Well, but this has really been the plan for a long time.
Right.
There was a man named Harry Elmer Barnes who wrote a book called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace.
Right. It's an interesting idea, isn't it, though?
And, of course, my friend Norman Dodd, before he died, when he was the director of research, the Reese Committee, had one of his people go through the papers of the Carnegie Foundation back in 1908 and 1909, before it was even ever incorporated, a woman named Catherine Casey, and according to Norman Dodd, and the interview I have with him, he tells how Catherine Casey found that the members of the board of the Carnegie Foundation, or Endowment for International Peace, what a wonderful name, had spent, the whole year of 1908 figuring out how they're going to bring about, you know, world peace and change the world. And they figured the best way to bring about world peace was to get us into a war. Uh-huh. Wars are how you change society.
Right.
And then, of course, they spent the year 1909 figuring out how they were going to get us into the war. So there really are people who think differently than you and I, than rational people, because they march to a different drumbeat. They dream a different dream. And what's so frightening is many times these people have great wealth and great power, and, of course, they're pulling the strings of where we're headed today. And I really fear, we're on the verge of World War III. I think we're being conditioned with all these articles on Iran, that Iran's a real threat. See, we're going to have to do something about Iran and Syria and North Korea. And of course, with depleted military as we have. But don't you worry, there's always something else they can do. Yeah. The president can come on and say, oh, shucks, I didn't want to have a draft. But now I'm going to have to draft your sons and daughters to send them overseas to fight for our freedom, because those wicked people over there are threatening the United States, and, of course, the North Koreans and Iran are about to ready to attack New York. We're going to have to attack them. It's going to be a preemptive strike, but we have the right to do that, to protect you. We'll be right back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. William Boorstin. Are you concerned about the fact that we may be moving into ever-expanding our warlike position in the Middle East?
Well, you quoted World War III. Well, it's actually Norman Porteritz had written an article for a Jewish commentary in, I think it was September of 2002, and he called it World War IV, and he really outlined the whole step-by-step procedure in Iraq wasn't even the war yet. We hadn't even been in Iraq yet. So that was the first step, and Iran was in there, and all the various evil empires, so to speak.
Yeah, but, of course, Norman Porteritz is part of the original 25 members of the Project for the New American Century that planned all of this back in 1997 and 1998.
Well, it sounded like he was writing Bush's script, and that was scary in those days. And I think George Bush kind of backed off from some of that. Iran, it's funny, if he were to reinstitute a draft, I think it would lead to an impeachment or something, because I don't think he could get away with it. I really don't. I don't think, unless we were hit again or another attack, which is, a possibility.
But there's, what happened if we did have another attack?
A dirty bomb? I guess are they preparing us for a dirty bomb?
Right, and they're psychologically, they are preparing the American people for another terrorist attack, and it will be blamed on the wicked Ayatollahs or the wicked, Korean dictator who's, but, will it really be from there, or will this simply be another example of the same domain, or will it be another Gulf of Tonkin attack? Yeah. Would it be something that's reused to get us into the war?
Right.
Would they really be adverse to staging something to justify the military draft? Would the American people be gullible enough to go along with it? What do you think?
I don't know. I think we go along with a lot of stuff, but this last war, certainly it was a great deal of dissension. It almost have to be a Democratic president to do that. I don't know if Republicans could get away with this war, you know. Maybe if we have President Hillary Clinton, maybe that's more likely to happen.
Well, I don't know. I'll tell you what I know.
You know, isn't she starting to act like a strong woman now? I mean, she's playing the defense committee she's on now with a very great aplomb and great skills, I think. She's looking strong on defense, and I have a sneaky suspicion the scenario you're outlining might be more appropriate under a Democratic president, you know, because they're the ones providing most of the war opposition, and I think most of the war opposition isn't the war so much, it's the fact that George Bush and Republicans are doing it. If it was a Democrat, I think they'd be wholeheartedly behind them.
What a tragic commentary that is on the situation we're in today.
Yeah, it is.
But, you know, the thing is that the Republicans are solidly behind this. I don't think that the average person in America ever would have gone... I don't think it's Dr. Stan back here. I was just saying I don't think the average American ever would have gone to war. Had it not been for what had happened on September 11th, I think September 10th, 2001, why, of course, the furthest thing from everybody's mind was going to war in the Middle East. On September 12th, so many people were ready to go to war. Everybody was flying their American flags.
Right.
And it just exactly happened after Pearl Harbor. In fact, the members of the Project for the New American Century have up on their website something called Rebuilding America's Defenses. It's a 72-page treatise on their master plan, the Project for the New American's master plan. Of course, you've got people like Norman Potterotz and Dick Cheney and, of course, Donald Rumsfeld and John Bolton and Paul Wolfowitz and Liddy and Elliot Abrams and a handful of Gary Bauer and then William Bennett, the Catholic, token Catholic, and Gary Bauer, the token Protestant, and in this organization, and certainly Norman Potterotz, his wife, you know, the neoconservative people, and they had a plan, and they laid it all out, and one of the things in that pamphlet, or 72-page thing, was the only way we're going to get our program in is to have another catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. If we had that, why, we could get our program in. And less than a year later, we had a catastrophic and catalyzing event like another Pearl Harbor. Isn't it amazing the major media has never quoted their statement?
That is interesting. Yeah, I was just thinking, I went to Hawaii last summer, and we took the usual tour, and it was a lot more crowded, and I just seemed more seeming, I don't know. It just seems it was a lot harder to do it than the past I've been there. But the interesting part I'm driving at is on our tour, it was 40 people on the tour, was a young man that had been in both attacks on the trade centers in New York in 93 and 2001, survived both of them. And I wish I had the presence of mind to have taken a picture with they had a guide. There was one of the survivors from Pearl Harbor, 81-year-old ex-Navy man. And the two people in the same room, I wish I had the presence of mind to have taken the picture of the two of them, but we've just gone through how Pearl Harbor was pretty much trumped up, what I've read at least, in my understanding. And I think there is evidence almost to a point that this wasn't exactly the most, attack in 01 should have never really happened. I don't know how we really allowed it to happen, but you can make a case why. I mean, it seems pretty, reasonable to estimate that. The two of them together, the only time, you really think that so close together we could have, people wouldn't start smelling around if it happened again?
I think that, when you control the media, you can make people believe anything you want to. Yeah. Well, let's go to Jim, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Jim. Good. How you doing?
Good, Stan. Thanks. I just wanted, you guys have kind of moved on for what you were talking about a minute ago, but you were talking about the Project for a New American Century and their treatise on rebuilding America's defenses.
Right.
And I just wondered if you guys had any thoughts on how that's reconciled with the fact that you know, the Bush administration is planning on shutting down American bases. They're not managing the southern border properly. You guys have any comments on that?
All right. Now, of course, you're talking about them not really guarding America, but putting all of our emphasis overseas. Is that what your statement is? How would you respond to Jim? Jim's concerned the fact that we seem to be much more interested in bringing democracy than to Iraq and the Middle East than we are to preserving America. We're cutting back on our bases here. We're not guarding our border, which doesn't really make sense. I mean, a nation that can put a man on the moon, that can send a probe to Mars, that can read a newspaper from space with a satellite, and we can't guard our own borders? So what would your response be?
I think we can guard our own borders. I think the reason we're not doing it is probably twofold, from what I read at least, is that the Republican Party, and I'm not so sure how much I believe this, but this is the answer they usually give. Republican Party is expecting to appeal to millions and millions of illegal immigrants, Hispanic people, and they see them an quarry of new voters, perhaps. I'm not sure that's true. Maybe even more importantly, the business interests that do move a lot of our commerce and a lot of our politics in this country, because of abortion, we've lost 41 million possible human beings that could have been working right now. I'm not sure that number's total, but it's certainly several million. That they seem to be a labor shortage in certain areas, in certain jobs that the ordinary American will not do, and so they're being able to cut a lot of their costs and keep the profit margin a little higher by importing or allowing them to import several million illegals that will serve in fear of being deported back to Mexico and other Latin American countries, that will help them run all these different businesses, and you know, as the sort of like a early immigration served as working for the Industrial Revolution. So I don't think George Bush has any intent to quell the immigration. They could do it in a minute if they wanted to, but I think that's the point. I think it's too many of the people that have kept him in power need these extra workers.
Well, but then if we really need the extra workers, why don't they bring them in on the Becerra program like we did 30 years ago, where they could come in with a temporary permit, they could come in legally, or they could live here, and then when they got ready, they could go back home again. Why are we refusing to do what's logical and allowing them to come in illegally? And so that would be the question.
Well, again you could say, I don't know if it's part of it, maybe it's a spin-off or side effect, that a lot of these illegals are responsible for a lot of the crime that comes in, too. So it might be another just social disrupting force that they don't really care. I don't really know. Sometimes you get into a real gray area there. It doesn't always all make sense to me. I really haven't had much time to think about that particular thing. But that is interesting. But maybe they don't want any record of these people, you know. I don't know why, but maybe it's the illegal part that makes it go.
Well, Jim, let me give you my 2 cents worth for what it's worth. For instance, if you didn't have a problem, how would you sell the idea of a national ID card? And then down the line, how would you sell the idea that we're all going to have a chip? I mean, we've got all these illegal immigrants in here. They're bringing in disease. They're taking our jobs. They're bankrupting our state's economy. They're driving up the cost of health care. They're driving up the cost of education. They're driving up the cost of, of welfare. They're getting food stamps. They're getting, and so you've got a problem. And it's a created problem, but now they need the problem to have the solution. It's the old dialectics again. Now we're going to have to, first of all, they're getting through this national ID card in the name of controlling the immigration, and it's not going to be used to control the immigration at all. And so then there's a problem gets worse, and you can begin to play the Anglos against the Hispanic, and you can pit one group against the other, and you've got a bilingual country instead of a country where you have one language, which, of course, what many people have wanted for many years. They don't want a solution. They want the problem. And, of course, as the problem gets worse, we're going to have more and more controls over the people. And I really believe this is a truly diabolical program. What are your thoughts, Jim?
For me?
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, I just don't see any consistent, plausible, credible plan for rebuilding America's defenses. I mean, they're shutting down military bases, and they're not controlling the southern border. Anybody can walk across the border. Terrorists can walk across the border. Drugs can be brought across the border. you know, at the same time that we've got now the Department of Homeland Security and the Patriot Act, and, you know, you got to be patted down at the airport, and, you know, you compare that with the southern border, it just doesn't make sense.
No, of course it doesn't make sense. If you don't understand, it's not supposed to make sense, Jim. It's all a matter of perception. It's to convince the American people we're really fighting a war on terrorism. That's why we have to have everybody searched while they go through the security at the airports. Of course, we can't profile people of Middle Eastern descent. We couldn't do that, so we're going to profile everybody.
Yeah.
Couldn't they use Homeland Security to go to leap to a national security corps without pretext of an immigration solution?
Well, they can do whatever they want to, and they're going to go ahead with it.
I mean,
they really want a fascist society. This is the objective of their
republic. It goes
goal.
Back to Plato again.
Right. It goes back to Plato. And if you understand Plato, I understand everything. Does that answer your question, Jim?
Yeah, pretty much, guys.
God bless. Bye-bye.
I mean, he's worried about the defense, but the whole point about the defense is that the American defense has to go if you're ever going to jump to a world government, because our American military was a great obstacle to the plans of some of these people. And that's why I was saying in Chapter 12 that maybe these wars have another purpose of depleting our military capabilities so much that we have just the last vestiges of a strong military. I mean, we have women in the military. Eventually, they'll probably go gays, and it'll do away with the... And once the gay people start flooding the military, you're going to get, just like the priesthood, a lot of times you're going to keep a lot of good people out. And the people that don't want to be part of that and don't want the problems that is attendant with that. And so, as a result, that's another way of undermining a valid institution as country, which is the United States military.
And I think that the military has always been one of the a very important institution. Duty, honor, country, these wonderful words and phrases. And they want to destroy every one of the fundamentals of our society.
By any means possible.
Right. And they've destroyed certainly our educational system. They've destroyed our religious system. They've certainly destroyed our financial system. And the military, I think, is one of the next targets. They certainly control the media already. So there are certain pillars of any free society.
I think the military
has been targeted.
The military has been under attack for several years
now. Well, I'll never forget one of my friends that talked to David Horwitz, who had been come from a communist family, and according to my friend Colonel Ron Ray, why David Horwitz had told him back in 1990 or 1991, when Colonel asked him, what about the religious aspects? You've talked about how you infiltrated education, how you infiltrated government, how you have been working in the military. What about the religious institutions? And Horwitz smiled and said, oh, that was the easiest one. Uh-huh. We infiltrated them 50 years ago.
Really?
And so I have no question at all. He was telling the truth.
Yeah, right. He's a red diaper baby.
That's what he referred to himself as, a red diaper baby. Uh-huh. You see, the communists understand what's going on.
Sure.
The people who hate America understand what's going on. And some of them have come out and tried to get the truth out. But because the establishment controls the media, you are never going to hear discussions like this on any major networks. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Why should people buy the Scorpion and the Frog? What are they going to learn if they get?
Well, I don't know how much is really original in it, but I really borrow from hundreds and hundreds of sources. If you want it all in one place, that's the way to go. It's sort of like the Walmarts of philosophy. It's all in there. I mean, it's a one-stop shop thing, kind of thing.
It really is. It's really a very big overview of the things we talk about here over and over and over again. And I'm sure some of our listeners get tired of this. But, of course, repetition is a wonderful form of education, and that's what I do. I'm not here to entertain. I'm here to educate. In the process, we have to entertain. But I want people to understand the fundamentals of our freedom and why we're losing it.
You know, if you're going to argue these issues, a lot of people come without any real fundamental mooring or foothold in philosophy, why these things are why. Anytime I get into an issue, I always like to know the philosophy that's behind it. And that's really what my book does primarily, I guess, is to delve into the deep philosophical underpinnings that kind of hold the whole thing together. And that's why it's sort of a unified conspiracy theory. It's not really trying to determine who killed Kennedy or what happened to the Oklahoma bombing or Waco or any of those things. It's to really delve into the philosophy that led us to those various situations where they became part and parcel of American history and world history, too.
And I think it's so important to understand Plato, to understand Kant, to understand certainly Karl Marx and the things he was writing about, to understand the relationship between Karl Marx and Darwin, you know, because they were, what, Marx was 1848, what was Darwin about 1859, somewhere in there?
It's sort of, they're all a common brotherhood of philosophy, so to speak, and one kind of feeds the other. Antonio Gramsci was a very important person, and if the cultural Marxist, the Frankfurt School, which gave us it gave us our cultural revolution in the 60s with Herbert Marcuse and Betty Friedan and people like that. The women's feminism movement wouldn't have happened without the cultural Marxist. Wouldn't have happened without Herbert Marcuse. It wouldn't have happened. Betty Friedan would not have happened without Herbert Marcuse. So these things all are interconnected, and that's what, you know, just like history, just like life, it's all links together and all has meaning. And the people that just think that things just happen because they happen, that's, you know, they're probably going to be the number one victims of the whole thing when it finally does crash, if it does.
Well, let's go ahead. We've got Paula. Hi, Paula. How are you doing?
You're calling from
Colorado?
No, I'm calling from Florida.
Okay, fine.
Oh, you're up later than I am.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I'm so proud of you guys for what you're doing, and I'm fighting as hard as y'all are. And the thing you were saying about the military, they are killing our troops off because they don't want them here so they can protect us, okay? And this is part of what the New World Order is doing. And
it certainly seems to fit, you know. If it's not pre-arranged or pre-directed, it's certainly going in the same direction.
Well, I know that they're giving them the reason they tried to get into anthrax, that was one way to try to kill them. Now they're killing them with uranium poisoning, you know, and this is all part of it. And it's sad, but we're in the last days, and, you know, we're going to be going through some pretty bad times. And talking about this people from Mexico, the reason they're leaving there, we found out from stevequayle.com, or he comes on WFLA, too, they're making them take the computer implant.
And no, they don't want making it. Who take the computer implant?
The people in Mexico.
Have they started shipping people down there yet?
Yeah, they already have. And Steve Quayle was telling us about it one night on WFLA.
Well, I'd certainly like to. Does he have anything written on that we could verify?
He's
that?
On his
I've
website.
Heard that they're doing that up in Oregon with just experimentally with children.
Really?
Well, he's on our website, stevequayle.com, Q-U-A-Y-L-E. And you get a lot of information off of him. And you get on the WFLA website, coasttocoastam.com.
Wow.
All right, well, thank you so much, Paul. Anything else you want to say?
Well, I just want to say that what you're doing is great, and, I mean, my family helped write this Constitution, and my family helped get this country started, and I'm a presidential family, too. Got George Washington is my godfather to my family.
We're proud of you.
You just keep up the good work there.
The good work, too, hon. I'm so proud of you guys.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Let's go to Tim calling from Indiana, Indianapolis, of all places. Oh, hi, good. Tim. How are you doing?
Oh, hi, gentlemen. I just would like to ask a question here. I see currently we have our president, Bush, Luciferian. Also, he's meeting with a Marxist, Putin.
Yeah, right.
So would you please comment on this? Thank you.
All right, fine. Would you like to comment on
that? Well, I mean, I don't know if there's anything special about a meeting Putin. You know, there's talked about, people have written about convergence and America's going to blend in with Russia. I don't know, but I would not trust Putin as far as I could throw him. He's KGB, former KGB, isn't it? You know, I don't think the communists really lost their stripes once they stopped being communists. They're still the same kind of people. And
they're still communists. I mean,
the same impulse.
Nothing has really changed. Did you see that 60-minute interview last night with Putin, and Mike Wallace?
No.
Oh, I'll tell you about it as soon as we get back here.
Sure.
Right here at Radio Liberty. Well, you know, the communists are pretty smart. They were having a big conference over there this last few days to celebrate 60 years since the end of the Second World War. So they had Mike Wallace come over to interview Putin, and he was on television last night on 60 Minutes. And here's Putin talking about God. God, you know. Well, I mean, this thing is all staged for the American people. The, I mean, this everything is staged, and he explains that democracy means he has a perfect right to fire all of the elected governors over there. That's what democracy is. They have a democracy over there.
Yeah,
it's only how you define democracy.
Right.
And he said, well, you criticize us, but, you know, you criticize us because we suppress the press over here. But what about Dan Rather? I mean, didn't he get fired because he came out against the president? And you know, he's got all of these glib answers. That whole thing was scripted for the impact on the American people.
Yeah.
And when the American people understand every time they turn on the television set why are they being programmed by the enemies of freedom, why they can understand it, what you have to understand is that the United States, in my estimation, has financed Russia since its very inception. We're still under any guise, whether it be giving money to protect their biological warfare from being stolen by the wicked Osama bin Laden, or destroying their chemicals to keep them from falling into the hands of the wicked Osama bin Laden, or helping them to dismantle some of their older nuclear weapons to keep them out of the hands of the wicked Osama bin Laden. Doesn't really matter. We're pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into Russia every year, as they're pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into new intercontinental ballistic missiles and into new nuclear submarines, and nothing makes sense unless I think you recognize there's a spiritual component behind everything.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, you've got 1 minute to wrap up the program.
Oh, my goodness. You want me to wrap it up?
Righty.
I just think that people have to start reading behind the lines of headlines, and as you're saying, there is everything that we read and hear is not exactly what meets the eye. There's a lot behind it. And I would also tell people to be a little reluctant to condemn people because they think there's a conspiracy out there. They promote some of these stupid conspiracies because it gives all conspiracies a bad name, and that's the whole point.
Would you like to give your telephone number one more time?
Yeah, my telephone number of Ex Libris Press for the book is History's Conspiracy, Scorpion and a Frog, A Natural Conspiracy, 1-888-795-4274. It's William A. Borst, and I'm the author, and I hope everybody at least look at the book. I think it will be food for your thought, and probably have a big banquet on it.
The Scorpion, the Frog. God bless. Thanks very much for being
with us. Thanks, Dan. I appreciate it very much.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest has been Dr. William Borst, and I hope you enjoyed it, the two-hour discussion, really, of what's going on out there. But as far as I must, in my opinion, we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And there's not one organization out there. There are many of them. And within all of these organizations, the inner core, there are people who've given themselves over to the dark side. Now, if you want, of course, to see this beautifully demonstrated, you need to get the videos we carry. They sold their souls for rock and roll. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version of that, and actually the price has come down on these. If you're interested in getting them, so give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour versions in DVD or in video. And then, of course, the excellent overview of these forces, these secret forces, occult forces working behind the scenes. Megiddo 1, 2.25 hours. Megiddo 2, 3 hours, both very, very professionally, really an overview of the dark organizations that really working behind the scenes. And what most people don't understand is there really is a spiritual dimension out there, and there are people who tap into that, the people who are into witchcraft, into Satanism, people who are the leaders of some of these organizations have tapped into the other dimension. It's not imaginary, it's very real. And, of course, you need to get some of the books that we're carrying. Of course, we carry this the books on the church growth movement. Who's driving the purpose-driven church? Deceived on purpose. Four tape set on the church growth movement. The video on Diaprax on the church growth movement. If you want to find out about the occult movement within the Catholic Church, the wisdom of Malachi Martin. All these are four tape sets, certainly the Church Growth Movement, the Wisdom of Malachi Martin, Satanism in the World Today, Aleister Crowley and his friends. We recommend these and so much, many other things available through Radio Liberty. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. You can get the book, the video, the audio tape, or get all of them together. The Brotherhood of Darkness special, if you would like, of course, to get a copy of our latest newsletter, The Myth of the Two-Party System. It's the March newsletter. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Please go to our website. And you can see the various items we carry. We carry, of course, the Berkey products and so many other things, but you can certainly listen to our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet or link to it. You can listen to our archive programs. You can, of course, pull down our newsletters and read them through and get the documentation on everything we say. And, of course, please tell other people about our website. Tell them about our programs. Encourage them to listen and then to join us in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation under God can long endure. And understand that we're all going to spend eternity someplace. We're all going to live forever. The only question is, where are we going to spend eternity? And if you were to die tomorrow and were to stand before the gates of heaven and you were to be asked, why do you deserve to be admitted? What would you answer? I mean, what right do you have to be admitted to heaven, you know, before the presence of a perfect God when you and I and just about everybody out here is certainly a sinner, and the only way that we have any hope of salvation is by the sacrifice of our Lord Jesus Christ and the belief in Him and His sacrifice for our sins. So understand the fundamentals of Christianity and then pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, we'll be back with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.